Broadcasting to New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Sydney, London, and around the world, this is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Radio Live, 101.3 KPCG. We're online at kpcg.fm. Coming up today, we have some listener response from the old mailbag. We'll get to those. OPEC's plans to raise oil prices hit a snag right here in Oklahoma. You're welcome. You have free speech at universities, just in tiny special zones. There's a story about that. And we'll talk about the intellectual history of Trumpism. What exactly is that? We'll get into it on today's edition of Trumpet Radio Live, 101.3 KPCG.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live on 101.3 KPCG. We are online at kpcg.fm. We have a live link at thetrumpet.com as well. And the TuneIn app, you can use that. We have quite a few listeners there. And if you'd like to follow us on Twitter, you can do that at kpcgfm. And if you'd like to email us, please do that. Comments at kpcg.fm. I'm Dwight Falk, Abraham Blondo here today. Grant Turgeon is not feeling great. Some sort of illness,
right?
Temporary, we believe, but so he is. I'm not sure what he's doing, but he's not here.
Yeah, hopefully I can be a worthy replacement for the day.
I think you'll do fine. You've got your sweater, and you're ready to proceed. We're both wearing sweaters today.
Yeah, actually, I was at Dollar General buying my wife an anniversary gift. I'm just kidding. I was buying myself a notebook, and I walked in there, and a lady came. She's like, "Wow, nice sweater." I'm like, "Oh, thank you." She's like, "Yeah, men don't wear sweaters anymore." I'm like, "Oh, well, that's interesting." She's like, "Yeah, my son wears sweaters all the time, and he always looks nice in them." But I'm like, "Oh, well."
She wanted more men to wear sweaters.
Yes.
Now we know what women want.
Yeah.
It's always a question.
Yeah.
They want sweaters.
And we're delivering today.
We are delivering.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, good for us. A couple of notes from listeners we mentioned yesterday. I just thought it was a funny story that they recalled a monkey bread mix. I'd never heard of monkey bread.
Right.
And a listener responded and said that, as a matter of fact, their mom used to make monkey bread all the time when they were younger, and it could be served sweet or savory. So there's a lot I don't know about the culinary arts, and apparently monkey bread is a popular thing. I just didn't know about it.
Yeah, I had no idea that was a baked good either.
There was a really good joke there that I totally missed, and somebody brought to my attention later. They said, "You should have just said it was banana bread." Monkeys like bananas.
Yeah.
I blew it. I missed it. One other note from a listener. A while ago, I mentioned my son and some other grade school kids. They have this thing where they don't want to be over-bundled for school.
Right.
They don't want to, I don't know, stand out in an odd way. They feel like they're a little too mature to wear all the stuff. Well, there's the other side of the coin, too. Somebody sent this story in relation to that. A school bus driver buys hat, gloves for young student crying from cold. So you've got the other side where kids are struggling. It's a pretty nice story. A bus driver in Washington State is making sure every student on his route has a hat and pair of gloves for the winter. He works for the Kennewick School District, and his name is John Lunsford. He's an Army veteran. He noticed one of his students was crying when he boarded the bus on Thursday. It was cold, didn't have a hat or gloves, so he gave the kid his hat or gloves, and then he decided he's going to go to the store and get 10 pairs of each. If the kid's cold, he'll hand them out. So, good job.
Yeah, that's nice of him. Because that can be very painful.
Oh, yeah.
In the cold. I remember waiting for bus stops, and I was fully bundled up, and I couldn't feel anything. Because it cold seeps its way through any amount of padding eventually.
On the bus route that I was on in school, there was a family that moved into the area. They come over from Asia somewhere. Like they were just over here for a few. They didn't have a lot of generations in the U.S. Any generations, they had come right over from Asia, so they were new to the U.S. and different culture, different way of doing things. And it would be really cold. 10 degrees, 5 degrees, maybe below zero. Never wore jackets. Just wouldn't wear jackets. I don't know. They had them, I think. I would assume. They just never wore them. They get on the bus in t-shirts. And we'd always look at them like, well, Don't you want a coat? They don't want one.
Wow, that's the next level of masculinity. That's big time.
Yeah. I don't know what the weather was like where they came from. I don't think it was, you know, it wasn't like they were coming from the Arctic or something.
Right.
But I don't know if they were just trying to be tough or intimidate us or what, but it was surprising. They didn't have any coats, or they didn't want to wear them. I think they had them, but just didn't want to wear them. So those are some responses from listeners. We always appreciate those. And again, you can send those into comments at kpcg.fm. We're happy to look at those. Some people are mad that Donald Trump won the election.
Right.
And some people are blaming things on Donald Trump that are not related to him in any way. This story, you might remember, this is the update. Muslim girl who alleged harassment by Trump supporters charged with filing a false report. A Muslim college student who alleged she was harassed by Trump supporters earlier this month while riding a New York City subway was arrested on Wednesday. Her name is Yasmin Saeed. She's 18. And she was charged with obstructing governmental administration and filing a false report. And so it turned out to be a big lie.
Yeah. That's when that story broke, I thought it was really interesting because a lot of people use that as ammunition during the election against Trump. It didn't work, obviously, but still, it just gives you an inkling of how many false reports there could be out there revolving around Trump supporters himself, or especially all those harassment allegations that surfaced just before he was elected.
Yeah, she didn't have any real big political leaning here, I don't think. She was confronted by police, and she admitted to making up the story to distract her angry father for having gone out late with friends. She got busted hanging out too late. Her dad was mad, and she said, "I got attacked by Trump supporters." Oh, okay. Well, there you go.
Yeah, too bad the story wasn't covered by Rolling Stone.
It was too close to the truth for Rolling Stone to touch that one. you have to be way, way away from any sort of reality there. There's another story today, some celebrity, I guess. I don't even know who they are. Alan Thicke, he died yesterday, 69.
Yes.
He's most famous for being the dad on Growing Pains. So he's playing hockey with his son. He was a big hockey player, or he enjoyed it, and he had a heart attack and he died. So, you know, it's a sad story there. And so this lady tweeted out that he died on purpose because Trump won. He just didn't want to be here anymore. And then today she had to apologize.
Right.
Again, not related. Not related.
Yeah, there was a one of the history podcasts I follow. They're doing this series on worse than 2016 because everyone's up in arms about how terrible a year this was because Trump was elected. So they're going through history and looking at all the things that are worse than what happened this year. And there's a huge list, just epidemics, wars, all these different things. But you always have a few people who come back and say, like, no, Trump's worse than the bubonic plague and
right.
the Great Fire of London and all these other things.
Yeah, you were even talking about that on the Trumpet Hour the other day, where, you know, I think they asked some people, well, who's worse, Donald Trump or Fidel Castro or, you know, some dictators. And people were like, I don't know. And it's clearly a ridiculous question. Those dictators have a very long history of killing many, many people. And here you just don't like this guy. Fair enough, but it's not the same thing.
Yeah, you may not like how he runs his business or how he got rich or his personality, but he's definitely not a dictator who committed war crimes against his own people. Yeah. So there does need to be a distinction in there. Because if you start making wild accusations or comparisons and everyone's crying wolf, if a wolf does come, no one's going to respond.
Yeah, that's right. It all gets back to the wolf.
That's right.
The wolf story. What story was that?
Don't cry wolf. About the sheep or the boy calling wolf and the sheep and something like that.
Yeah, the boy cried wolf. The wolf shows up in all kinds of kids' stories.
Yeah.
So I was like, now the wolf's been in a lot of them. Why is everybody mad at the wolf?
It does remind me of a Far Side cartoon where it's a bunch of wolves dressed up as sheep. And you can tell they're all wearing sheep costumes. And one stands up. He's like, all right, are there any real sheep here?
Right.
There's just a big group of them dressed up as sheep.
There's, you know, I think generationally we remember some things from growing up and we might reference them as we get older. And then the younger generation doesn't know what we're talking about. There was a song in the 80s. I think it was Duran Duran, Hungry Like the Wolf.
Oh, yeah.
And so if I get hungry around the house occasionally, I'll say, I'm hungry like the wolf. Kids don't get it. Don't get the reference. But that's what I'm referencing.
Yeah.
It's 80s pop culture.
In my class earlier today, I I mentioned Xena, the Warrior Princess. I had no idea who it was.
I won't ask why that was mentioned, but okay.
Because we were talking about Xerxes, the Persian king, and his name. It's weird. Like, it has an X at the beginning, but Xerxes, like, with a Z. And I'm like, oh, it's kind of like Xena. And they're like, who's that? I'm like, oh, it's kind of like a discount Wonder Woman. And they're like, oh, I guess that makes sense.
Yeah, it was a thing years ago. Yeah.
Yes.
One of the things going on at the college campuses is protests and free speech and offenses. I'm offended by your free speech, and I'm offended that you don't want me to have free speech and back and forth. So this is from Forbes. College officials tell students, you may speak freely as long as it's within our tiny speech zone. So they've set up free speech zones that, and you have to go and you have to ask the college administration if you can go use the free speech zone for free speech. And it's like 0.2% of the campus area. Very small. You have to get permission. I guess you have to run your comments by them or something. And then you might be able to go use free speech. Is this happening? Is this a real thing? It's a real story. It's unbelievable.
Is it free?
They didn't say that. The university certainly isn't free.
Yeah, that is just incredible that it's free speech is under attack and where the place it should be being protected the most, and that's education in America, especially especially in a college campus where people are formulating future careers, where the leaders of the future are being taught, and where people kind of figure out who they are and what they believe in, and in a place like that where there are zones that you live in. I mean, this isn't the Cold War in Eastern Germany where there are certain zones you can go and where you can't go with the Berlin Wall. I mean, to me, it's almost like an intellectual type comparison because it's you can't – the whole point of America is that someone can think and say what they want. I mean, there are limits on that. But so there can be free debate so we can find the right answer so we can find a better way forward.
Well, the universities are doing this because they're trying to limit what people can say. So there's pushback against that. Like, hey, you can't stop us from doing that. So their response has been, okay, well, you can do it in your tiny little space. We'll allow free speech, but, you know, again, not really. And then that raises another question. Like, what if you go into the tiny zone, but your words are heard outside the zone? You know, because technically now your ideas are outside the zone, even though you physically were inside the zone. What if you get a loudspeaker?
Right.
All kinds of questions that come up from this type of thing. So, I mean, can you go in the free speech zone and then, like, send a tweet globally from the free speech zone? I mean, it just gets ridiculous after a while. They say that this free speech zone tactic is being used now because there's claims, again, against the college, some of the universities, that they're not allowing students to exercise their First Amendment amendment rights. The Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, or FIRE, there you go, has concluded that roughly 1 in 6 colleges and universities have these zones. 1 in 6. So I assume the other colleges you can do it anywhere, I guess. I'm not sure. But 1 in 6 have these free speech zones.
Yeah, that's especially for the amount of money kids pay for to go to those places or don't pay for.
Yeah.
That's ridiculous that they have to live under those kind of circumstances, or that universities are being forced to come to ridiculous solutions like this. Well, solutions in quotes. But those remind me of some of the courses at these universities where I guess it's freer speech in the classroom. Some of these classes revolve around activism towards Israel or just very overt politicization where the class is so bent in a certain political direction that if you disagree, like an example of this class about Palestine, if you disagree that Israel does have a right to exist, you don't fit into the course description or the point of the class. And they encourage students to engage in activism over Israel.
Right.
Now, that's, to me, that's not an objective path. That's not free speech. If that's if you're put in that class where you choose to join it, then you have to think that way. That's so it's not surprising that students feel like their free speech is under attack in the classroom. And even now, just on the campus itself, you can't say whatever you want unless you're in this 0.2% of the campus.
Yeah, it's they say officials at Grand Valley State University in Michigan have imposed a speech zone policy as one of the examples. Under university rules, students have full expressive rights, but only inside two very small areas on campus, amounting to about 0.02% of its total area. Moreover, students must first obtain permission from officials before they engage in any speech or expression activity within the zone. What if you inadvertently walk through the zone, like you don't know it's there, and you say something, and you didn't get permission? Like, what's the punishment? They're making up all these ridiculous rules that you can't really govern, and I don't even think, how would it even hold up? And that's the thing, some people have gone to the courts and said, hey, they're infringing upon my free speech, and the courts have said, yeah, they actually are, and you can't stop them. And so the colleges are trying to come back with this zone. But again, how are you going to implement these rules? And what's the punishment? Duct tape on your mouth?
Did you probably have to build a wall around the 0.2% free speech zone because the ideas in there are too dangerous.
It's like the Wi-Fi zone. I'm not getting any Wi-Fi here. I need to go to the... Yeah.
It's a hotspot.
It's a hotspot.
But yeah, it does just... It is really disturbing, obviously, but it does bring up the point that if you can't govern people's thoughts with rules, I mean, and that's the whole point, is that there are ideologies, there are things out there, and we have rules in society that govern behavior, obviously, so there's an anarchy. But what goes on in someone's mind, that's why people believe in things. That's why we have people believe in religion, because they want to have some kind of force that governs what they think or how they act. So when you've, and so what they're doing here is really they're trying to regulate people's thoughts. Because if you can't talk or say what's on your mind, except you're in this free speech zone, you're really regulating what they're thinking. And that's a really dangerous thing.
What if you're not in the free speech zone, but you're playing something like a radio station or a recording of some kind, and you're not saying it, you're just playing it?
Yeah.
Ridiculous.
What if you're playing a Bears, or if you're a Bears fan in Michigan?
That brings up a lot of questions there.
Can you only wear your jersey in the free speech zone? Or
it could be offensive. Yeah. That's a good point. You have to do that in the stadium. You have a little, for the other fans, the others can be in that area. Sometimes people use free speech and then they do something that's probably not the smartest. Have you heard of this guy, the Santa-hating pastor?
Yes.
Yeah. He's coming to Dallas-Fort Worth. David Grisham, the Amarillo pastor who preaches an anti-Santa Claus message inside malls, told CBS 11 that he is coming to Dallas-Fort Worth to do his thing, be on the lookout. He said he will come into town, scout the area malls, and then decide which one he wants to do it in and when. Officials from several malls in the area told CBS 11 that they are aware of his intentions. None of the mall spokespeople would address the Grisham situation specifically. They weren't in a free speech zone at the time. But they did offer information on their policies regarding disruptions. A spokesperson for Hulin Mall issued a statement that said, in part, if someone is causing a disruption, they will be asked to stop and eventually asked to leave. And then one of the residents there, somewhere in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, is quoted as saying, I'm pretty big into Jesus myself, but I managed to find room for Santa Claus, too. Well, there you go.
Interesting.
So probably not the smartest thing for this guy to do, because people don't want to hear that, especially in those malls with their kids all sitting there. And, you know, it's just one of those things where you can have a good point about something, but got to use a little bit of wisdom, I guess, as to where you bring that point up. That's not the audience that wants to hear your message right then.
Yeah, there is a, especially in this kind of society, there's a time and place for a message for people who want to hear your message. And people can find the platform you're on or go to the building or speaking in. I mean, that's the way to do it, not to go to a public venue where people aren't there to listen to anything except maybe annoying Christmas music all the time in the malls. But, I mean, they're there just to do their thing, go about their day, not be harassed. And so if anyone had any message, never mind just this kind of thing. I mean, how annoyed do people get when you have salesmen trying to sell you things in like mall kiosks?
Oh, yeah.
But now you have a guy trying to sell his version of the gospel while your kids are sitting on Santa's lap or you're shopping or whatever you're doing. It's just a disruption of like a public place, and that's not the best way to get followers or supporters.
Yeah, so he's not going to be a popular guy, that's for sure. But he thinks he's doing something good, I guess. We have a really good program about the Christmas topic on the Key of David program. You can find that at thetrumpet.com and get some good information about that holiday there. And we have some good write-ups at The Trumpet as well. So check that out if you're interested. Mall kiosks. I'm always sort of impressed by those people. You have to take rejection all day, and you keep doing it though.
Well, I think it's the common experience of any guy dating girls growing up. but yeah, it is amazing that they have all this stuff, and like the phones, the watches, the hats, whatever it might be. And it's always full. It doesn't look like anyone's buying anything, but they're still making money off of it, I guess.
I guess. I'm always amazed when I see people actually looking at stuff. I'm like, you're going to buy something from that kiosk? That doesn't seem like... If you're going to buy that gold necklace, I don't think that's the place you want to do it.
Yeah.
But who knows? And then they always come out and they try to get the ladies to get the perfume or the hair product or lotion or something.
Yeah.
They're really aggressive. It's interesting to hear some of the things they say.
Yeah.
Just don't make eye contact. Keep walking. You'll be okay.
The one that I see is popular is massage chairs.
Oh.
People, mm-hmm. like, I guess it's not really a kiosk, but you go there, you put money in, and they...
Yeah, that's actually probably not a bad little deal.
You get a public massage.
Sure. I just can't relax here at the mall. That guy's yelling about Santa over there. And I'm just too stressed. Yeah, so the mall is, of course, busy this time of year usually. This is from Bloomberg. One of the things that OPEC is trying to do is reduce some of the oil flow in order to raise the prices. They want to make some more money, but it's being threatened by us. Oklahoma. OPEC threatened by tiny Oklahoma town with soaring supplies. They say for OPEC, there are a few enemies more fearsome than the tiny Oklahoma town of Cushing. It makes me laugh because I think of like all these sultans in Saudi Arabia and then everybody in Cushing.
Yeah.
Two different worlds there for sure, huh?
Yeah, that's just interesting how the whole oil system works, where even sometimes in this case, people with just a little bit of power can really disrupt the whole system if they want.
Yeah, they say with oil inventories at Cushing creeping near an all-time high, U.S. benchmark futures prices are struggling to advance despite the promised production cuts agreed to by OPEC. I guess Cushing wasn't invited. They didn't get the message. The storage tanks are likely to stay full as refiners park crude in Oklahoma to lower their tax bills. Cushing, which prides itself as the pipeline crossroads of the world, is the delivery point for the West Texas Intermediate Crude Contract, with tanks that can hold 77 million barrels of crude. That's a lot, by the way. Enough to supply France for 2 months. It's or my SUV for a week. No, I don't have an SUV. It's the biggest storage hub in the U.S. They say the last high point there came in May. Now, after a brief hiatus, the tanks are filling up once again. For the OPEC-led efforts to boost prices, that's a major problem. Too much oil sitting there in Cushing.
Yeah, that's a really interesting story. And I think it does show, I think a lot of people are confused, or even I don't really understand how the pricing for oil works that well. But
here's the only thing I understand about it. If they come out and say, hey, prices on oil are rising, the gas station immediately raises its prices. But then on the flip side, if they're like, oh, yeah, prices are coming down, it takes a couple of weeks for it to hit the gas. That's what I've noticed.
Yeah, well, exactly. That sometimes the prices seem arbitrary, or like even in this area in Oklahoma, if you just move over 3 miles to the east, the prices increase 5 cents.
Mm.
Because there's no competition that part of the county, so right. Everyone has to go there so they can raise the prices. So it's really interesting the way it all works, but that it's pretty much arbitrarily done by the oil companies based on like supply and demand, and if they want to make more money or if they want to lower prices, or if Saudi Arabia is trying to undermine Iran's economy, they'll pump more oil in to lower the oil price. So it's just a really interesting, complex thing, but that it's really arbitrary. It's based off of what the strategies of a few people want to do.
Yeah, those small town gas stations. Boy, that's a racket, isn't it?
Yeah.
You go in there and you're like, wait a second, this bag of chips is $5. But at Walmart, it's like $2.99. But I don't want to drive all the way to Walmart. The guy's just making bucks.
Yeah.
It's irritating. Cushing's not a big town. Most people, well, of course, around here know that. But if you're listening online, you might not be aware. 7,889 residents. It's about 70 miles northeast of Oklahoma City, where we are. It says over the years, it's developed into the key transfer point for oil flowing from West Texas and Canada to refineries in the U.S., Midwest, and the Gulf Coast. Since late October, Cushing inventories have increased by 8.1 million barrels, largely wiping out the 9.9 million barrel drop from mid-May to mid-October. But, you know, it's interesting, too, because we've had a lot of earthquakes here. You do have to start wondering, like, if that would become an issue. If anything severe happened, you got all that oil sitting there. It's right. Something to think about.
Yeah, especially with oil pipelines spanning great distances. I mean, they have a lot. They have a pretty sophisticated system to stop oil leaks or flow if it's flowing out of a damaged pipe or that kind of thing. But these areas are pretty vulnerable, especially to if the ground moves. So does the pipe. So it is a that is an interesting point. To see if, I mean, it's too late now, I guess, to change all the infrastructure. But if that does become a factor in the future and how they do things across the United States. Because I know, I think I saw something where Trump might pick up the Keystone Pipeline again, perhaps. So that would be another pipeline, a huge one, coming into the United States. So that would be interesting to watch, too.
I saw a story the other day. You know, they're protesting the pipeline up there in, where is it, South Dakota, North Dakota, somewhere?
Yeah, I forget where it is.
One of the Indian tribes is up there protesting, and a couple of, like, C-level celebrities that pop in for the weekend. Yeah. And they had, like, a leak just on a pipeline right not far from where they were.
Yeah.
So it's just strange that that happened, but I didn't see all the details on it. Of course, this one's happening. You a fan of the self-driving Uber?
Not a huge fan.
I'm nervous. I don't want a robot driving me around.
Yeah.
Like, I just don't like that idea. Self-driving Uber apparently runs red light in San Francisco. And people are, of course, filming these.
Right.
It says a self-driving Uber car was caught on camera apparently running a red light in San Francisco Wednesday. Uber launched the fleet of self-driving Volvo SUVs Wednesday morning, just hours before the incident. What do you say to them when they go out there? Be safe. Robot car.
Make money.
Yeah. Come back. Come back at the end of the day. Dashboard video from a Luxor cab, of course. They'd be wanting to find this. Captured the Volvo apparently running the light after the taxi had stopped for the light just in front of one of the buildings there. According to Uber, the cars aren't yet ready to hit the streets without someone monitoring them. So there was somebody in the car from the company. So they say it was the person's fault. So apparently the person from Uber ran the red light. Take your pick. Machine, man, they're all going to run red lights, I guess.
Yeah. Maybe that's part of the new software for the machines. Just if you can get across the red light, you should.
Well, yeah, they that's probably like the one error they made in the software development.
Yeah.
So, oh, red was stop. Oh. No, we flipped that. We have that reversed. Is that going to be a game changer?
Maybe the robot just got a really good tip, and he had to get there as fast as he could.
I don't know. He ran the red light, and then there was another example of it almost hitting a train or something, one of those street trolleys.
Yeah.
And so it'll be interesting. I can't see it working. There's too many chances for it to make mistakes. Humans make mistakes too. I get that, but you know, how often are you working on your computer and it just doesn't do what you want?
Yeah.
That's all the time. But here it's driving you around. I kind of like that.
Yeah, do you want Windows 10 driving your car? I mean, that's not what it is, but I mean, look at all the problems with anything, like you mentioned. But even the human mind is infinitely more complex and better than anything any computer mankind can make. And even, as you said, people have problems driving cars with the great brains and nervous system that we do have. So a robot trying to replicate that isn't the best idea, because there are going to be a lot of errors, and even if they have to test it, at what cost does it come with this technology? Because, I mean, this is people's lives on the line. It's not just laboratory testing.
Yeah, I'm not going to do the self-driving Uber, I don't think. maybe someday I'll end up doing it against my will, but I'll be forced into the Uber car.
Yeah.
But I'm gonna plan on not doing it. You know, they could really trick you. You get in there and it looks like a person, and
yeah.
You start driving, that like the head rotates all the way around, and it's like, hello, welcome to Uber. Like, that's not a person.
That's like in the, Arnold Schwarzenegger futuristic film where he becomes a spy on Mars or something.
Isn't that every Arnold Schwarzenegger movie?
Yes. Okay. But anyway, all the taxis have like the fake people in them, and their heads turn and have this weird smile, and they're like,
right.
"Okay, yeah. I'm not getting in that cab.
Not getting in that one." Yeah, that would be weird. So anyway, that's one of the things going on with Uber. We'll see how that works out. Keia David program's coming up here in a bit on KPCG. Two programs today. You can listen for that. And also the Trumpet Daily Radio Show with your host, Stephen Fleury, from Edstone, England today. And you can get those archives at kpcg.fm if you can't catch it live. Or we have replays throughout the day. So the schedule is there at kpcg.fm also. And some people like to get it from thetrumpet.com. There's a plethora of options. Just wanted to say plethora. Have you ever worried that people might run out of whipped cream, that you might not be able to find it?
Sometimes, I think my wife does, but I haven't worried about it.
Nitrous oxide shortage sends canned whipped cream lovers into a frenzy. Grocery stores throughout the country are running low on canned whipped cream following a fatal explosion at a Florida nitrous oxide plant in late August. I guess this is a true story. A spokeswoman for Conagra Foods confirmed to Fox News that there is currently a nationwide shortage of some of its whipped topping products, including Ready Whip. She says, "We are proactively managing the production of Ready Whip." I would hope they'd always do that. Do you usually not proactively manage it? It just happens. And are doing the best we can to make it available to as many consumers as possible. So in other words, business as usual. So yeah, you might not be able to find Ready Whip because of the nitrous oxide shortage.
Yeah, I think this actually might be a blessing in disguise for the health of every American in the United States. And I, for one, am willing to allow the death of Ready Whip whipping cream if it allows for the death of Easy Cheese, aerosol cheese.
Yeah.
If this will bring about the death of aerosol cheese, I'm willing to sacrifice Ready Whip.
Yeah. No more of those high and heady days of spraying it directly into your mouth.
Yeah.
You have to ration it now. Use it wisely. A couple of comments in the story were funny, per usual. One person says, "The Russians blew up the factory to help Trump whipped cream business." I think that came directly from the CIA. And then one of the person says, "I'm surprised no one has blamed President Bush for this."
I think they might have to rename the company Unready Whip. So.
Yeah, it was a ironic title.
Yes.
Probably Whip. Potentially Whip. And then, of course, the obvious comment somebody made was, whip it good. So there you go. You can make it yourself, you know.
Yes.
It's better for you, and it actually tastes a lot better.
Yeah. It actually is cream.
Yeah.
So...
because that stuff that comes out of those cans is just some sort of chemical compound. Obviously everything is, but but it just feels very like it came out of a factory and not out of some sort of normal food place.
Yeah. To me, it looks too much like whipped toothpaste.
Shaving cream.
Yeah.
Could be anything.
Yeah. I mean, why not use a shaving cream? It doesn't taste bad when some gets in your mouth. It's,
yeah, I think you stumbled onto something.
Yeah.
Just put that on your cupcakes. Here you go. And then if it's somebody with the beard, it's like they got two for the price of one.
That's right. Eat your cupcake and then shave.
And then shave, yeah. I guess if you had a beard, you wouldn't want to, but
yeah,
you know what I'm saying. Interesting story you've got here, Abraham, from Politico. An intellectual history of Trumpism. Trump's ideology, they say, has deep roots in U.S. history, but this is the first time it's made its way to the White House. So what exactly is Trumpism?
Yeah, so this is a really interesting story because, as the author David Greenberg points out, a lot of people look at Trump as a showman, someone who just unintelligent, kind of just sees the moment, doesn't really have any intellectual backing behind him, behind his ideas, his policies. But in this article, he actually points out how Trumpism, the policies of Donald Trump, his ideology, is actually just an amalgamation of lots of failed Republican or conservative ideologies over the past century. There are a lot of historical similarities in how they came about. So it's pretty interesting, and he uses a lot of big words to describe it, like paleoconservatism.
Is that like the paleo diet?
Yes, or okay. Like paleontology.
we make some no good... carbs, only meat products.
At least there's no Ready Whip. But he makes a good point here that this paleoconservatism or Trumpism, it's really a combination of all these different people who have an idea after post-Iraq War, post-crash 2008, post-Barack Obama. All these events cause a backlash or a reaction in the public, And so this new Trumpism is a combination of all those different reactions of how what people are expecting from the government. So the post-war Iraq, the Iraq War went very poorly. And so everyone's kind of withdrawing from U.S. intervention, where we saw U.S. troops used poorly, a lot of money wasted. So it's a reaction to that. It's a reaction to the 2008 crash where the economy almost tanked, and then a lot of, especially middle class people, have lost a lot of income, and I'm just like, healthcare is going through the roof right now.
Yeah.
And then post Barack Obama, where we see a lot of progressive agendas come, and that's reacting against a lot of people who are maybe Protestant or evangelicals, people who have a little more traditional ideologies. They're seeing this as a threatening thing, so they're reacting against it.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, isn't that kind of the definition of being a populist?
Yes.
I mean, you're just going with the popular thinking and riding that wave. And it was really interesting when he was when the election was still or the campaigning was still happening. It was early. It was before even I think he was even the nominee. Still kind of early on, but he had a lot of popularity right away. And there was one conservative talk show host that I happened to listen to briefly, and the people that were calling in, they were talking about like how they perceived Donald Trump. And they just the main thing they said was fiscal conservatism, which I don't know that he'll be that. But I mean, they want basically at the end of the day, they want the economy to be good. They want to make money. The rest of it they don't care about because they were talking about morality on the conservative side. Like, are you for gay marriage, against it? They said, we don't care. That's your business. Do whatever you want. But we want to make money. And I think that kind of, to me anyway, summed up some of people's thinking. As long as the economy is good, I've got mine. I'm not that interested in the rest of it.
Yeah, and the Man of the Year article from Time magazine about Trump has some great stories of people in Michigan and other places where they took big hits over the last 8 years financially. And so they're looking to Trump to reverse that trend. And so I think that's a big part of it. And in this article, he really goes through how in two periods, post-World War I, post-World War II, you saw a movement among right-wing conservatives to become more isolationist. And it was a big reaction against the liberalism of Woodrow Wilson and FDR. So Woodrow Wilson was the first American to envision worldwide liberalism. He had the 13 points that created the League of Nations. He wanted international liberalism where everyone works together for common good. And so a lot of Americans didn't necessarily like that because they were thinking it would undermine American sovereignty, that America would become the puppet of all these other nations around them. And then with FDR, of course, you have the New Deal, which is a huge power grab of the executive, where the executive gained a lot of power over the economy, a lot of more government funding, welfare states, the welfare state with Social Security. So you have this liberalism in domestic policies, fiscal policies, international policies. And so in the right, they were reacting against that. You have isolationists running for the White House, Republicans saying they don't want to go to war in both world wars. But really the big turning point was Dwight Eisenhower. When he became president, he's the one who made the Republican Party the party of internationalism. That we are America is going to help the world, that they are going to fund the world economy, that the Republican Party is a globalist party. And so Dwight Eisenhower took all the steam away from these people who were wanting to be more isolationist until Donald Trump.
Yeah, and it's interesting you mention Eisenhower because one of the things that came up during his term in his two terms in the 50s, was that of race relations in the U.S. It was a really hot topic then as well. And he didn't really do a lot about it, but what he always said was, get the economy right and it'll take care of itself. As long as the economy's working, and he said, you know, my job is to pump money into this economy. And if everybody's got money or has enough, those problems kind of take care of themselves. They don't totally, but probably the overall thinking there was sort of accurate. And I think that's kind of what they're thinking today. Again, like, well, let's just get the money flowing. If we got money pumping in, things will take care of themselves. And So there's some similar thinking there, at least on that economic point.
Yeah, because why do people ride or have time to ride? It's because they're unemployed. Usually they're younger. They don't have any savings or like a pension or anything to go off of. And so a lot of social discontent comes from young people who can't work or don't have any money. And the solution to that is to give them jobs, get everyone money. When everyone's prosperous, they don't really think about some of the other social problems in the nation. And that's another key element of this is the social change. So in America, 50s, 60s especially, you saw the civil rights, especially for African Americans, become center stage in American politics. And so with all these civil rights, you had a lot of Americans have a backlash against that because they thought it was a threatening to their lifestyle, to their way of life, to their livelihoods. And that's also what we can see in this era where you have a lot of social change, gay marriage, the bathroom laws. You have all these different things that are starting to infringe on people's religious beliefs. And so we're seeing a reaction against that as well. And so these ideas that Donald Trump is using, they've been used by other conservatives before him, except he's the only one to really have the leadership and the charisma to actually make it happen.
Yeah, and the other side is, I think, so caught in their echo chamber that they don't understand that for some reason. You know, I think most people, when you watch, like, let's say, police get shot, or you watch riots in a city, people don't like that. And who wants that? Nobody wants to live in that city.
Yeah.
Nobody likes to see an officer get shot. We want law and order. So what did Donald Trump come out and say? I'm the law and order candidate. People responded to that. Did he give any ways of how he was going to do it? I didn't hear any. But people still like the message. And the other side was so caught up in Black Lives Matter and all this. Yeah, there are some people that maybe are supportive of that, but most aren't. Nobody wants to live in a burned out city where people are getting murdered left and right. That's just not a popular thing to run on.
Yeah, exactly. And that's, I think, part of the reason why he's so successful is that he saw these trends and he capitalized on it. But I think another thing to remember is that the rise of Donald Trump is the fulfillment of another historical cycle in American politics where we've seen these things in the past, just they were never strong enough, or another leader stepped in the breach, like Eisenhower, a conservative leader who was able to quell those kinds of policies from becoming popular, or even Ronald Reagan. Populism like this was becoming popular in the 70s when Carter was messing everything up. But Ronald Reagan came in. He was a more moderate candidate, and he was able to really set the bar for the Republican Party until now. And so you have the interesting thing is you have these cycles repeat, except this time there's no leader who can counteract a Donald Trump in the conservative party.
Let me ask you this question, see what you think about this. President Obama, crazy like a fox? You know, the question is somebody crazy or crazy like a fox?
Yeah.
He took things so far in the progressive movement that they're coming back, but they don't come back as far as they would normally. And is that what he wanted to do, you think? Because, for example, Democrats now are open to replacing Obamacare, but they're saying, yeah, we don't mind tweaking a few things. And even the president himself has said, yeah, he could tweak a few things. Like, do you think he intentionally pushed things so far, knowing that it wouldn't stick right now, but it would come back to somewhere in the middle and be more progressive than when he started?
Yeah, I think that's the only way you can do it, is that there's a long history of taking a more moderate course. It takes too long. It takes more than just one presidency to affect that kind of change. So I think his strategy was, especially for a lot of these initiatives like healthcare, gay rights, all these other special projects he had, even climate change, if you make an indent in American legal landscape. So President Obama took this huge sledgehammer and he hit the ground really hard, where you can try to fill in the hole he left, but he still altered the landscape enough where he made a difference. He altered it in some fashion. And I think that's what we're seeing here with the American laws, with how we govern the country, where he changed things so much that there's no way we can revert back 100%. We have to accept some of the changes and try to like fill in the gaps that we don't like.
And do you ever get a Donald Trump elected in a situation where it's not post Barack Obama. You know, reaction to that. Like, I don't know. It would be interesting to see, but he's pretty out there as far as a candidate, you know, compared to what you normally would see. But then on the other side, you've got Hillary Clinton, who is about as unfit as possible, you know, despite what the media says.
Yeah, well, it's you could think of it like a chemical reaction. When you have an acid, you have to use an alkaline to neutralize it. And the stronger the acid is, the stronger the alkaline to neutralize it. I think with President Obama, he was so far left. The only way people are thinking you can neutralize it was someone who's more far right. And in Donald Trump's, he's more even moderate. He's not really that far right. Some of his policies could be considered far right, but he's very liberal himself.
Yeah, and I mean, some of what he says is pretty extreme. But in a post-Barack Obama landscape, it's actually refreshing to hear. To hear somebody say radical Islamic terrorism. To hear somebody say, we got illegals pouring in this country. You know, we're in some deals that are horrible. You know, that's pretty extreme talk in some ways, particularly when people are running for president. They're usually a little more careful in how they address things. But because we've heard all these things the last 8 years that have just, I think, bamboozled so many people. Like, what is this? If that's the right word, bamboozled. it's really shocked people. That even though some of the statements coming from Donald Trump are shocking as well, they're, like you say, they're that really strong alkaline response to that really strong acid that we've had.
Yeah, and I think that's another missing element from this historical cycle we've seen, where there wasn't someone extreme enough in government. The closest was FDR with his New Deal policies. There wasn't a Democrat left enough to justify someone with these paleo-conservative ideas coming into the White House. Because people like, they have some good ideas, but they're still too extreme. Let's find someone more moderate. That's why General MacArthur couldn't become president, because he was too extreme. That's why a lot of these other isolationists couldn't become president, because they're too extreme. So they elected Dwight Eisenhower, who was more moderate, and he was the right man for the job anyway. But now, like you said, with Barack Obama, a man who broke all barriers, broke laws, and just really changed the Democratic Party to the extreme left. It just paved the way for someone like Donald Trump to take up the mantle of paleoconservatism and go into the White House.
Yeah, right guy at the right time for that job. So there's a lot at thetrumpet.com about the current politics in the nation. Great Again, and also America Under Attack. Those are two really good ones. If you haven't read them, get them as a set. They go together very well. Everybody, of course, uses smartphones, right? Almost everybody.
Yeah, almost.
There's a few that probably don't. These are the five best smartphones of 2016. So you can go buy all five.
I imagine the Galaxy 7 is number one.
Well, they don't rank them. Yeah, right. Yeah, it's on fire. They don't list them in order. They're just throwing them out there. They're saying these are some pretty good ones. The Google Pixel XL, that's a new one on the scene. I'm not familiar. I mean, I have no experience with it other than seeing the commercials. It's intriguing. I Google things.
Yeah.
But so anyway, I think all these are kind of do the same basic stuff. It's just, what do you prefer? But so Google Pixel.
Yeah, I think people who use Google a lot, like Google Documents and their other cloud services, I think this phone would be perfect for them because it's integrated into the software, so it makes it really easy. Mm-hmm. So I imagine that's Google's looking after a very small niche part of the market. But Google has great technology as well.
You can get the Pixel starting at $649, 32 gigs, or the larger XL, $769. Also, of course, iPhones on there, iPhone 7, iPhone 7 Plus, and the iPhone 7 Minus. No, I'm just kidding. There's no iPhone 7 Minus. Still pretty new phone, but a very popular as well. It starts at $649, and the 7 Plus is $769. So they're all in the same price range, pretty much. Here's another one, the OnePlus 3T. I'm not familiar with this one.
OnePlus.
5.5-inch phone, consistently rates high on major review sites because it offers solid flagship features at a lower cost. OnePlus is a new Chinese smartphone maker that's only been around since 2013, but it's been pretty popular so far. It's a little cheaper. It starts at $439 for a 64 gig option. So that might be something to look at if you want to spend a little less.
Yeah, I think that's the big problem with smartphones is they are so expensive. Mm-hmm. Especially in an economy where people's wages are going down, you can have people like this company in China produce it cheaper than you, sell it for cheaper, and with more than what you can buy with $300 more.
Yeah. Still a lot of money for a phone.
Wow. Yeah.
Samsung Galaxy S7 Edge. The Samsung Galaxy S7 Edge is indisputably one of the best smartphones in the world. Hey, that's what they said. I didn't write it. The 5.5-inch Edge offers an innovative curved AMOLED display, which is both nice to look at and practical, allowing for Edge apps. It has the best battery life yet for a Galaxy flagship phone. The S7 also has, according to more than a few major review sites, the best smartphone camera going. I'll have to vouch for that. They have a pretty good camera. There are nice extras too. Micro SD slot for upgrading from the standard 32 gigabyte storage. Samsung is expected to announce the Galaxy S8 in March timeframe. So you can never stay up with it. You think you got the latest and greatest. Nah, there's something else out there.
Yeah. I read an article a few months ago where it said pretty much they've reached the wall with the smartphone. Basically all the advancements that might get a little bit more memory or better battery life, but they're pretty much going to be the same. Because I'm just not sure what the next step of the smartphone is. Like, how can you take it any further than where it's at?
Yeah, you have to kind of, I don't know, the technology has to catch up with it or something. Like, there needs to be something new. iPhone was such a game changer. The iPod before that.
Yeah.
Such a game changer, you know. Because you don't need to have music on CDs anymore. You can put it all in this device. But now what's, like you say, what's the next thing? You can what can't you do on a smartphone? You want to watch something, you can do it. Listen, you can do it. Documents, you can do it. So I guess there'd have to be something we just haven't thought of yet.
Yeah, like something like there's a see-through screen or I have no idea, hologram technology. Something ridiculous like that. And even that stuff's pretty useless.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Sometimes they come out with something and it's different, but you think, well, I would never use that, though.
Yeah.
Like, I think, I don't know. For me, the jury is still out on the smart, or on the iWatch. What do they call it?
Right.
Is it called
the
iWatch?
Yeah.
Okay. You've got to have it close to your phone, and so it's just like another little mini phone.
Yeah.
And some people have them, and that's great. I'm not trying to rain on your parade. But to me, I just don't quite get it. I'm like, well, if I have to look at my watch to like answer a call or something, why wouldn't I just pull the phone out of my pocket?
Yeah.
Maybe there's reasons for it. I just don't get it, though.
Yeah, it's same thing with Google Glasses, where it's neat technology, but it's so impractical in this life that you couldn't really use it for anything. There could be some military applications I was thinking about, but that's something that the normal consumer isn't really too worried about. Google Watch, just it's big, and you don't want to hit your... I never spend more than $5 on a watch, and the reason for that is...
And you're always late.
Yes, but the reason for that is that you just smash your forearm and everything, like, or you roll on it awkwardly, or stuff spills on it. So if you have a watch that costs hundreds of dollars, that's a mini phone, to me, you're just asking for heartache.
Yeah, well, that's true, too. The more you spend on something, the more you... It's like when people buy a really, really expensive car. And you can tell they're so worried and they double park it everywhere.
Yeah.
And, you know, you don't want anything to touch it. It becomes kind of a liability almost more than an asset in some ways.
Yeah.
But, I think what Steve Jobs was so good at is finding things that people wanted to do, making it convenient and easier for them to do it in a package that they liked.
Yeah.
And, that you know, you can't really force people to want to do something. It kind of has to be something they want to do, you know. Driving around and being able to find where I'm going with the directions on my phone, great. I love it.
Yeah.
Checking things on the internet, love it. Emails, love it. But there's things that they offer that it's like, well, why would I do that, though?
Yeah, so, exactly.
It has to be kind of within the realm of what you're already doing. So I'm sure somebody will figure out something. They'll be the next wealthy individual, but I don't know. I don't know what it would be. Shooting a laser, that'd be kind of cool.
Yeah, they have flashlights. Yeah.
Yeah. I can't think of anything. I'd have to go back and watch old episodes of Star Trek.
Right.
Try to figure out the machine where it just makes the food you order. Like, I would like that.
Right.
But then I'd be way overweight.
But you have an endless supply of Ready Whip.
Yeah, that's right. I don't have a problem with that. I have a dispenser on my phone, Ready Whip dispenser. So those are some of the smartphones that are out there. I think there was one more, actually. Well, the iPhone SE. So, yeah, that fits into the iPhone family. Those are some of the phones out there if you're looking to get one. If you're behind the smartphone curve there, or the edge, as it were, you can get one of those phones if you want to get rid of a small fortune. Got too much money to spend. I got to do something to go buy another smartphone. That'll do it for us today on Trumpet Radio Live. Thanks for joining us. And have a great rest of your day. Kia David program, Trumpet Daily Radio Show on the way. For myself, Dwight Falk and Abraham Blondeau, enjoy your Thursday. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG.